All right, well, good morning. Let's start off this morning by turning to our neighbor and say, God's love has no limits and it's here for you. God's love has no limits, and it is here for you, and it's here for our youngest among us. That was for Carter. Let me go ahead and dismiss. If you are one of the young ones, the youngest among us, you are dismissed, released, free. Thank you, Ava Joy. Thank you, Ruth. For those of us in here, let me invite you this morning to turn to Matthew. We're returning to Matthew chapter 5. If you're grabbing a Pew Bible, 684, the words will be on this lovely screen behind me. We are returning to Matthew and the Sermon on the Mount. By way of remembrance and to get us all on the same page, Jesus, he is up on the mountainside. His disciples, his Talmudim, his followers have gathered around. Jesus is teaching. And most recently, he has been giving us examples, illustrations, giving us a picture, showing us the kind of life that reflects the heart of God. The kind of heart that reflects, showing us this way of life that really flows from the Torah. The Jesus backstory that is the Torah. Keeping in mind, again, Jesus makes it very clear, right? He says, do not think I have come to abolish, kataluo. Do not think I have come to do away with, get rid of, cancel the Torah or the Nevi'im, meaning the prophets, Torah and Nevi'im, meaning the Tanakh, what we think of as the Old Testament. Do not think I have come to do away with, cancel, get rid of, abolish. But he says, I've come to fulfill, pleroo. Again, this idea of to uncover, to reveal, to express the deeper intent, the deeper heart, the deeper understanding, the deeper meaning of the Torah, of the Tanakh. And he says it comes by way of a righteousness that surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, that of the Pharisees and the scribes. Surpassing, not meaning doing more, not doing more than, it doesn't mean do better than, it means different from. The scholar R.T. France, he says, Jesus is not talking about beating the scribes and Pharisees at their own game, but about a different concept of righteousness altogether, a different understanding of how we should live as the people of God. What is a different way of righteousness, Jesus says, as he reaches back into the Torah, and he says, a different way of righteousness than simply do not murder. I mean, do not murder, yes, Jesus is down with that. But he says, it's more than is there a dead body. God's heart is, he says, my heart is that we would see one another, we would see the other as made in the image of God, as image bearers of the living God. He goes on, not just do not murder, but do not do adultery. Right? And he says again, yes. And again, God's heart is so much more. Right? God's heart is more than a dead body. It's more than a naked body. It's that we would see each other made in the image of the living God. And the way that we then view and treat one another, the way we engage and embrace one another, right? That we would see beyond the label to the whole person. He goes on to speak of oaths and vows. He speaks of eyes and teeth and cheeks. And he, in essence, he says, look, the way that we talk, the way that we talk to and about one another, that matters. The way that we deal with our disagreements and our differences, he says that matters. And then here today in verse 43, chapter 5 and verse 43, one more time, he says, you have heard that it was said. And with that, again, he reaches back generations long before. He reaches back to the very beginning. And what was heard, he says, we read, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And so again, Jesus begins by quoting the ancient scriptures. He goes back to the Tanakh, back to the Torah, more specifically here to Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 19, the opening line, the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, 'Be holy, because I,'" meaning in the same way, "I, the Lord your God, am holy." And then from there, we read all these sorts of different ways that we are to treat one another, the ways that we are to engage with one another, including down to verse 18, it says, we read, "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against any of your people." And then it says, "Love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Now from there, it gets a little bit blurry because yes, in Leviticus, we have love your neighbor, but the second half of that phrase, "and hate your enemy," is nowhere to be found. It's not in the Tanakh, in the whole of the Testament, Genesis to Malachi, certainly not in the Torah. Although, having said that, there are a number of passages that promote this idea of what we would think of as like a harsh view or a punitive sort of attitude toward one's enemies. We find that kind of a sentiment, Exodus 34 and 12. It says, "Be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land where you are going, or they will be a snare among you." Maybe more directly, Deuteronomy 7 and 2. "When the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, you must destroy them totally. You must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy." Even the psalmist gets into it. 139 and 21. "Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I consider them my enemies." So point being here, although "and hate your enemy" is not a direct quote, as Leon Morris says, he does appear to be summarizing Jesus, summarizing the way the interpreters of his day saw the teaching about enemies. The call for hatred is certainly the kind of addition to the command that many have put into practice. As Hendrickson says, "In such an atmosphere, it was impossible for hatred to starve. It had plenty to feed on." The scholar R.T. France, he says the key is the lawyer of Luke 10, and Luke 10, that would be the story of the Good Samaritan. As the lawyer of Luke 10 perceived, the key lies in the meaning of neighbor. For most contemporary interpreters, the term was restrictive, leaving non-neighbors outside the command to love. Hence the popular addition, "and hate your enemy." And so Jesus, in effect here, he first goes back to the Torah, but then he also brings in contextually kind of the reality of the day. He then goes on, "but I tell you," he says, "love." And again, we can think back to last week, if you were here, the heartbeat of resurrection, right? It is simply and it is profoundly love, right? A love that expresses itself in care and compassion for others. And here we see that perhaps in its fullest form. I would say certainly in its most challenging, costly, demanding, maybe not simple, but certainly profound form, right? "But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven." Now, if you've been around the Bible, if you've been part of church, maybe even outside, this idea of "love your enemies" that Jesus speaks, we probably have heard that before. But I want us to understand and get today the radicalness of what he's saying. I mean, it is completely upside down bonkers, this idea of "love your enemies." And think about Jesus as he was speaking to his disciples. Right, in that day, remember, Caesar is the all-powerful ruler of the world. Right, the Israelites are, in effect, they are an occupied people living in an occupied land. They are under oppression. Yes, in a way there is peace, but it's peace at the edge of a Roman sword. And Jesus says to those in that condition and says, "Love your enemies." Keeping in mind, many in that day believed that the way forward was to go to war. To go to war with Rome, against Rome. In fact, it was just probably a few years after Matthew wrote his gospel that they did go to war. It was AD 70. And Israel was decimated. The second temple was destroyed. And it's into that reality that Jesus, again, he says, love your enemies, which is entirely upside down. Right? I mean, love your enemies by definition, right? Your enemy is not loved. Your enemy is not somebody that you love. I mean, that's why they're your enemy. Now, with that, there is the nuance here of love as well. And when we think about in our world today, when I think about it, love kind of stretches what I think of as this sort of vast absurdity, where we speak of love in the same sentence in relationship to a covenant and to a canine, right? The intimacy of sacred vows and a small dog in a sweater, right? It's like we say in one breath, I love my spouse, I love my family, and in another breath we say, I love hot dogs and chihuahuas. And so there's this sort of absurdity there. But in the ancient world, this language of love was maybe a bit more nuanced. It was more finely tuned. In fact, there were a number of different words for love in the Greek. There are a number of different. There are four that are kind of considered the classic words. The first one is eros. Eros. Sophocles, he called Eros a terrible longing. It was that kind of romantic love. It was filled with passionate desire. It, over time, began to change. And so whereas at one point it was considered not so much in a negative light, over time, in fact, it was Plato who said Eros is a longing for beauty and the divine. And so it had this elegance to it. And yet over time, especially under Roman influence, Eros became more and more associated with what we would call lust. Now with that, and that was certainly true in Jesus' day, that Eros was more associated with lust. Philia is another word. Think of it as friendship love. Think of companionship, maybe loyalty. Trust. I mean, think of the one who is your truest and maybe closest friend. William Barclay describes philia as a word of warm, tender affection. There's also the word storge, which is more family love. It's that love between a parent and their child, between a child and the parent, that a parent has for a child has for a parent. It's born of time and belonging. It's more of that what we might think of as a natural love or an instinctual love. And then with that, there is agape. Likely familiar with agape. We've talked about it here before. A sacrificial love, a self-giving sort of love. It's that kind of love that gives with no expectation of return. It's that kind of love that we speak of, you know, that Jesus has for us, that unconditional kind of love. Probably my favorite definition is a benevolence and goodwill that seeks nothing but the highest good of the other. And it's that Jesus says, it's that agape that Jesus speaks here regarding enemies, right? This determined sort of benevolence, this unwavering goodwill, right? Seeking nothing but the highest good of the other. Right, especially those who are causing you harm, those who are against you, those with whom you are at odds. Pray for them, he says, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. In short, translation, meaning because that is the heartbeat of God. That is the heartbeat of God, which is why he then goes on and he says, He causes his son to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you agape those who agape you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? In God, writes Barclay, in God there is this universal benevolence even toward those who have broken his law and have broken his heart. In the words of the psalmist, the eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food at the proper time. You open your hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing. Right? It's this pouring out of benevolence and goodwill, right? Even for those who stand against you, even those who are opposing you, even those with whom you are at odds, right? Seek nothing, he says, but their highest good. And then he wraps it all up here. Verse 48, he says, be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Which at first glance, in second and third and fourth, seems rather daunting, right? Even impossible. The idea of being perfect, right? Like it's this kind of distant, unreachable ideal. And yet really it's far more grounded than that, far more pragmatic, far more practical. The Greek here behind perfect is teleos. As Barclay sums it up, a thing is teleos if it fully realizes the purpose for which it was planned, designed, and made. And to that point then, the noun form is telos. Telos means an end or a goal or a purpose. And so, in effect, something becomes teleos when it is living into the purpose for which it is created. And so you are, Jesus says, you are teleos when you are living into the purpose for which you were created. And he says the purpose for which you are created is, in a word, simply and profoundly, it is love. It is agape. No limits. Right? That purpose for which you are created, it is a benevolence and a goodwill that seeks nothing but the highest good of the other. No limits. No limits. Now, as we wrap up, Jesus here is speaking of enemies. Right? Specifically, he's speaking to us about enemies. Right? Again, those with whom we are at odds, those with whom we disagree, don't see eye to eye, those not like us, don't think like us, talk like us, those that don't believe just like I believe, think like I think, walk like I walk, talk like I talk. And the reality is, and I want to make it clear, Jesus is speaking about that other. But I think if we're honest, oftentimes we are our own worst enemy. And in some ways, Jesus speaking, love your enemy, hits right here. It's not that, it's not out there, but it's in here, right? That part of me that feels like I don't measure up. That part of me that I've tried to push away, that I don't like about myself. That wound that I try to hide. That part of me that feels like it doesn't fit, it doesn't belong, doesn't measure up. Right? That part of me where maybe I feel too broken. God can't love that part of me. Right? And so I become my own worst enemy. And so as we move into just a few moments together, I want us to sit in the stillness together and a couple of questions to reflect on. I want to kind of begin there and ask, what would it look like for you to just simply rest in the agape love that God has for you? No limits. What would it look like today, this week, this season, just to rest in God's love for you? Along with that, we could maybe ask, what part of your story needs to be surrounded by God's love today? I mean, we've all got a story. We've all got parts of us, whatever that might look like. So what part of your story needs to be surrounded by God's love? And then with that, how is God inviting me to live more fully in the way of agape? And that's kind of a transition, right? Not only toward myself, that part of me within that I dislike, that I don't agree with, that I don't get along with, that I want to disown, but also for others. How is God inviting me to live more fully in this way of agape, right? No limits. What would it look like in each moment to love as God loves? In this moment right here, right now, to love as God loves. Sitting with yourself, sitting with your neighbor, sitting with those in this space. What would it look like in each moment as you walk out the door, as you go about your day, your week? What would it look like each moment? How might I embrace each encounter with a purposeful love? Each encounter that I have today, tomorrow, how might I engage each with that purposeful love, right? Agape, no limits. And then maybe with that, with whom is God quietly inviting me to practice agape? Again, maybe that's you. Maybe that's you loving you, allowing God to love you, and inviting God quietly into that space. And then with that, as we head into the week, what situation is calling me to cultivate benevolence and goodwill? That situation, that circumstance, that condition, what situation is calling me to cultivate benevolence and goodwill? Where is the Spirit inviting me to labor for another's highest good? Where might prayer be the first small blossom of love? Not only loving, but he says pray for. Where might prayer be that first small blossom of love? And then whose burden is God asking me to lift in love's embrace? Right? Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you,